The comments within the following podcast are those of any show hosts and not representative of any company in which the show hosts may represent.
Welcome to Tech, Podcast 338. I'm Jared Reimer, and I have something special for you. I told you all that I'm going to be publishing some of these webinars that I thought was interesting. This is a podcast where one of those are given to you. The first segment is an overview of Assignment 18 in the Braille Transcription course. Instead of just talking about the Braille aspect, I try to make it more generalized, explaining it in a way that maybe other people might get it, even if they aren't Braille readers and are not necessarily interested in the Braille transcription course and where I am. It's a 12-minute segment, and I hope you enjoy that. The 60-minute segment, which is the bulk of the program today, is a webinar in December from John Clay and Trend Micro, Critical Insights from IHS Market Vulnerability Research. It was quite interesting, and while it's an entire hour long, and it includes Q&A, it was very valuable, and maybe somebody can get something out of this. Lots of data here, and I hope that you enjoy it as much as I did. Final thoughts and contact information at the end. Without any further ado, let's get started. This podcast is packed. Welcome to podcast number 338. I have one large segment for you, so I'm not going to be too long on this one. I want to talk about assignment 18 of the transcription course here, although I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on it. It covers quite a large amount of items that you would think should be split up into multiple segments. The particular assignment is special formats, lists, columns and tables, poetry, suggested formats, menus, recipes. And the assignment wants us to put each individual section onto its own page and also there are gotchas in there too, like making sure that page indicators are where they need to be. And Braille 2000 has several new percent codes, such as page R, which will hide the running head, and then it'll appear on the next page, so you can have a heading or a title, if you will. The interesting aspect of this is that my experience from when I was a child tells me that I have had no idea how to transcribe poetry. And in the Braille Formats book, it is section 13, and I helped Braille Institute with that. Now, I'm not going to cover the assignment in any more detail, but that in itself should be in multiple sections because it is a lot to cover. The good thing is that they don't really cover tables. And that's probably for the better. We do cover table of contents as part of a very lengthy assignment 19. Now, I will stop here and say that for those who are not into the Braille transcription or Braille discussion aspect, you're not missing a lot. I will tell you that print in itself, in the very first portion of the assignment, tells you that print itself is very complex. And Braille has to accommodate that. I will also tell you that the sentences in prior lessons of the assignment were done in list format. So we've been using list format practically through the entire lesson. This has something called nested lists. And nested lists can also be done in HTML. For those who are not aware of that, in HTML per se, you can have a nested list as follows. Unordered list. Braille 2000, the talking edition. Numbered list. Braille 2000 has many options, including colon, and then maybe an unordered list. And what you do in HTML is you close those tags in the reverse order in which you open them. Like I said, it's very complex. Now, I know there are some people that aren't interested in the Braille aspect, but it is kind of the same way. Michael in Tennessee, for example, he said, you know what? The Braille stuff doesn't interest me, and I completely understand that. But if you tie it in to how print works, the whole thing is very complex, and a transcriber, whether they are sighted or blind, need to understand how to format it properly for a Braille reader to read it. Tables themselves are quite interesting, to say the least. And I'm not looking forward to doing table of contents work. I have read plenty of table of contents work. And I've also read plenty of Braille in my life, especially the numbers on the trains. You just got the alert that the Blue and Expo lines were resuming normal service because they had a delay. I've been on those trains, and I've read the Braille on those. And yes, they're only numbers, but that's only half of the battle in Braille itself. Could you imagine trying to learn HTML and not being able to understand it? Well, that's what Braille is to the sighted. And if they want to be a transcriber, they've got to know the ins and outs of how it all works. Just like HTML or CSS. In assignment 18, not only are we doing paragraph and list, but we're adding other aspects of symbols in the print curriculum. We're adding bullets for bulleted lists. We added superscript in an earlier assignment. We added other money symbols in earlier assignments. And the whole thing can be put together to make a very complex, organized thing for us to read and for you to understand that the print world has the same symbols. And that's how I'm going to tie this together so that everybody understands how complex this is. I've talked throughout the entire podcast about how there have been challenges. And this is a challenge because the poem that I'm now needing to do is multi-leveled. If a sighted user like Michael in Tennessee has read poetry in multi-level format, there are indents, and it's not all in one column or even one line. It could be several levels deep. The Braille Formats book goes into a lot more detail than the lesson, but the poem that I'm going to be doing next is one of these multi-leveled poems, which my mentor is saying has several levels to it. And this outline that I'm also needing to transcribe has five levels. Outlines are basically nested lists. And if you understand how to write an outline in print where you tab, you know, the Roman numerals at the margin, A, several cells or several spaces in, number one, several spaces in from that, A again, several spaces in that, and all of that is a nested list. And if you understand the aspect of the print with what the Braille has, you can, without understanding every single aspect of this, you can understand it to a point without being able to read it. I will stop here because I could go on and read examples and read what this is all about, but I won't, because it's going to be too complex to try and explain in a reasonable amount of time. Coming up next, I am going to play one of the sessions that I've recently attended. And this time, Critical Insights from IHS MarketWatch, the December webinar from the Trend Micro Group. It was quite interesting. And I know that it's going to be lengthy, but well worth the listen. I found it very interesting, and I think you will too. So that is going to be the rest of the podcast, ladies and gentlemen. I will be back with the rest of our information on how to contact me and all of that after this webinar is complete. Thank you to Trend Micro for hosting this webinar. I hope that people find it of value, and this is December 2019's webinar.
Hi, everybody. My name is John Clay, Director of Global Threat Communications here at Trend Micro, and happy to have you join us today on our webinar. We're going to get started here in just a minute, but a few housekeeping points before we get started. You'll see on your screen right now, we will have questions and answers at the end of our webinar. You should have a little Q&A button on your screen that you can enter any questions that you have. So feel free to put one of those or any questions that you have as we go along in the presentation. There's also a resources button. You can check out that widget for a lot more information and some assets, links to assets and so forth. You also have a question button to help widget. So I'm happy to have the senior research analyst at IHS Market with us, Tanner Johnson, today to help us with this presentation. We're going to be talking about the public vulnerability market. So Tanner's going to start us off today, and then I'm going to come back at the end and do a couple of informations about some of the things that we're doing here at Trend Micro. And then finally, we're going to break for the question and answers. So with that, I'd like to welcome Tanner Johnson, who is Senior Analyst, Cybersecurity Technology at IHS Market, to go over the research that his organization performed. Tanner, take it over.
Introduction, John. I appreciate it. Thanks, everyone, for attending this webinar today. Ultimately, I'm the lead analyst focusing on cybersecurity and IoT security at IHS Market, with contributing analysts with Sean Peterson, Jeff Wilson, and Liz Cruz overviewing the overall research of the security, information security vulnerability market. Ultimately, we wanted to provide kind of a comprehensive study of the market. My background is in both aerospace and defense, as well as I went back to school and got a master's in cybersecurity to focus on understanding the complexities of the threat landscape going forward. So we wanted to provide kind of a foundational understanding of the overall market. So we provided kind of an initial executive summary to break down our findings and to clarify the basis of our research. We focused on research and analysis on a dozen organizations that are responsible for disclosing information security vulnerabilities, and the 12 are listed there in our report. But I'll mention them individually. Obviously, Trend Micro Zero Day Initiative, Google Project Zero, US CERT, Cisco Talos, Palo Alto Networks, McAfee, FortiGuard Labs, Checkpoint, Kaspersky Labs, Accenture's iDefense, Flexera's Secunia Research, and SecureAuth. Now, as a primary component of this overall research, we needed to cross-reference the data provided from these various vendors against that information which is publicly disclosed by various government agencies. And these include the MITRE Corporation, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or the NIST, and the Computer Emergency Response Team Coordination Center. This is the CERT-CC. Now, while the CERT was listed with other reporting organizations, the CERT is not a security vendor of any kind. Overall, the scope of our analysis was limited to those vulnerabilities and those vulnerabilities that were credited to a vendor, ultimately responsible for managing the disclosure of the vulnerability. Many vendors have their own vulnerability advisory websites that provide insight into various vulnerabilities, but they may have absolutely no hand in managing the disclosure of the vulnerabilities listed. They could simply have a web scraper that looks throughout various internet sources to grab a hold of various vulnerabilities and then broadcast that information. As part of our research as well, all vulnerabilities in our analysis had to be disclosed within the 2018 calendar year. And all vulnerabilities had to be verified and published by an independent government organization. This verification is necessary and essential for any common vulnerability and exposure number to be assigned. While there are a multitude of reasons for a vulnerability not to have a CVE number attached, unfortunately, there are no additional metrics that can be identified to that vulnerability or verified without having a CVE number attached. These additional metrics include the common weakness and enumeration values, as well as the common vulnerability and scoring system values. The total collection of all vulnerabilities for the dozen vendors we did research for in 2018 was 3,069. Of that, 2,731 had CVEs attached to those vulnerabilities, and 338 did not have a CVE attached. Some of the disclosed vulnerabilities and associated CVEs were either uncredited or credited to organizations outside of the various vendors outlined in our scope. For instance, the MITRE and NIST National Vulnerability Database, which we will go into further. In 2018, there were over 30,000 vulnerabilities disclosed, but we had to limit our scope to just the 12 vendors we were doing research within. As a result of those vulnerabilities not being credited to to the 12 vendors that we were researching, we didn't include those extra vulnerabilities into our analysis. There were instances that we did encounter, however, where a vulnerability was claimed by two or more vendors. And as there is yet no independent government authority on establishing credit to an individual vendor for a particular vulnerability, we simply had to grant credit to all vendors claiming responsibility. As a result, 1,454 vulnerabilities were claimed only once, 80 vulnerabilities were claimed by more than one vendor, and 46 vulnerabilities were claimed three times. And this resulted in a total of 1,580 unique and verified vulnerabilities. However, as we have to attribute credit for each vulnerability to all vendors who claim it, the resulting total of all vulnerabilities claimed by the 12 research organizations that we worked with within 2018, the final total was 1,752 vulnerabilities. Our overall methodology of our analysis was to conduct, conducted in the report was for adding as much research and material as possible from primary and internal research, individual vendor interviews. We were able to collect data from open source publications as well as various publicly disclosed reports. We collected all publicly available vulnerability data from each of the organizations listed in the executive summary, and we assigned credit for each vulnerability captured. However, in order to be attributed credit for a listed vulnerability, an organization had to be responsible for effectively managing its disclosure, meaning that the organization directly orchestrated the release of the vulnerability. The credit for managing a vulnerability was not attributed to a vendor simply because it was listed on their publicly facing advisory website. IHS Market, we also then collected information on verified vulnerabilities during 2018 using the NIST National Vulnerability Database and the data feeds stored in the JSON file format, and use this data and the corresponding assigned metrics as a baseline for cross-referencing and vendor comparison. To be considered verified, all vulnerabilities in our analysis had to have an associated CVE number attached in order to prevent rejected or duplicated entries from being introduced into the analysis, as well as having a CVSS value assigned by the National Vulnerability Database. Vulnerabilities without a CVE, while credited to the vendor listing them, could not be included in our analysis. Additionally, the CVSS and the CWE metrics assigned by the National Vulnerability Database allowed us to conduct a comparative analysis of the performance of all vendors, the severity of the vulnerabilities they discovered and disclosed, as well as the attack methodology used for each of the vulnerabilities credited. So we had to conduct research and analysis of the broad vulnerability market itself. Some fundamentals when it comes to, you know, various vulnerabilities. Ultimately, a vulnerability is a weakness, it's an error, a flaw that poses a threat directly to the CIA, holy trinity of cybersecurity, that is confidentiality, integrity, and availability of information within a computer system. And the overall scope of the report is to analyze the data within the vulnerability market, as well as the vendors that contribute to the discovery and the publication of the vulnerabilities themselves. Hackers are consistently seeking to take advantage of any vulnerability present in hardware, software, firmware, so they can seek ways to exploit or compromise the systems that these vulnerabilities reside on. Unfortunately, the greater the window of time between discovery of a vulnerability, its disclosure, and ultimate remediation, this provides greater time for a potential hacker to exploit that vulnerability. The window of opportunity becomes larger. Vulnerabilities that exist but are unknown to the affected vendor are referred to as zero-day vulnerabilities. These pose the greatest threats to information security because they are viewed as the greatest prize for hackers to attain and share. As vulnerabilities can only be addressed once they are discovered and shared with the affected vendor, there's an incentive to report a vulnerability as quickly as possible. However, even if a vulnerability is mitigated through a patch or an update, the threat may still remain for every user who hasn't implemented the corresponding security fix. And while the initial intent behind disclosing vulnerabilities is to make effective components and systems more resilient to compromise, there are particular complications that can ultimately hinder an otherwise noble intent to share this information. The vulnerabilities can have negative connotations associated with them that can provide effective resolution, a hurdle to address the issue, as some vendors have chosen and end up being reluctant to actually recognize out of public fear of public scrutiny or potential government penalties from the recognition of the vulnerabilities in their systems and services. Public disclosure processes have evolved in recent years, and this has allowed for greater transparency, accountability, and standardization of the vulnerability handling practices and procedures. As more vendors, security organizations, researchers continue to contribute to the overall process, the associated threats introduced by various vulnerabilities can be mitigated with greater efficiency and effectiveness. The potential impact of these various vulnerabilities vary greatly, as some flaws may merely be annoying, while others are critical enough to have potentially catastrophic consequences for the vulnerable systems and its respective users. So in order to conduct the comprehensive analysis on these vulnerabilities, there are several characteristics and values that need to be identified first in order to provide cross-reference and deep dive into the details across all reporting organizations. That includes the common vulnerability and exposure values, the CVE, the common weakness enumeration values, CWE, and the common vulnerability scoring system values, CVSS. The common vulnerabilities and exposures values, this number and classification system was founded in 1958 by the MITRE Corporation, established as a federally funded research and development centers by the U.S. government. The National Cybersecurity System and Research and Development Center was operated by the MITRE Corporation, launched the CVE list at the end of the 1990s in a way of providing overall reference and methodology to track and the publicly disclosed information security vulnerabilities. The National Institute of Standards and Technology launched the National Vulnerability Database in 2005 and provided information and characteristics for that list. The CVEs list, the overall list of entries themselves, are used in various cybersecurity products and services around the world to provide that additional context and verification and validation. The National Vulnerability Database built upon and fully synchronized with the CVE list so that any updates to the CVE list appear immediately in the National Vulnerability Database. The corresponding relationship is that the CVE list feeds the National Vulnerability Database, which then builds upon the information provided in the CVE entries to give it enhanced information, as well as fixed information, severity scores, impact ratings. And as part of its enhanced information, the National Vulnerability Database provides enhanced searching features, such as by operating system, by vendor name, by product, version number, vulnerability type, etc. The CVE values and numbers are specifically assigned by a CVE numbering authority, a CNA, of which there are several key types. There are bug bounty programs. These are assigned CVE IDs to products and projects that utilize various bug bounty services. National and industry certifications, computer emergency response teams responsible for performing incident response and vulnerability disclosure services for nations and industries. and may assign a CVE ID as part of their particular role and scope. There are program root CNAs that oversee the CNA program, root CNAs that are responsible for managing a group of sub-CNAs within a given domain or community, various vendors and projects assign CVEs for vulnerabilities they discover in their own products and services, as well as vulnerability researchers who can assign a CVE ID to various products and projects upon which they perform a particular analysis of various vulnerabilities. There are several reasons why a CVE might not be assigned to a vulnerability. Each vulnerability has to be tested for authenticity and validity prior to being assigned a CVE number. The process can be lengthy, unfortunately, and depending upon the severity of the vulnerability in question. As a result, the testing to provide validation may not take place within the time of the publication of the MITRE CVE or the NIST for a particular calendar year. This can ultimately delay the inclusion of a vulnerability into the next calendar year, despite being discovered the year prior. As part of the development of the CVE list, MITRE CVE team designed a preliminary classification and categorization system of vulnerabilities, attacks, faults, and other concepts to help define common software weaknesses, and this is the common weakness and enumeration value. But this effort was designed to, or ultimately deemed too rough to be used alongside the offerings of the code security assessment industry. As additional data surrounding effects, behaviors, and implementation details were also needed. The first attempt to revise the CVE categorization took place in 2005 as the part of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, which sponsored the National Institute of Standards and Technology Software Assurance Metrics and Tool Evaluation, the SMATE project. This resulted in the creation of the Preliminary List of Vulnerabilities Examples for Researchers, PLOVER. It's a working document that listed over 1,500 different diverse real-world examples of vulnerabilities identified by their CVE name. The next step after PLOVER was to establish acceptable definitions and descriptions of the various weaknesses by the community under the NIST-SMATE project, which led to the creation of the Common Weakness Enumeration List and associated classification taxonomy. The resulting CWE list that we now utilize serves as a mechanism for describing code vulnerability assessment capabilities in terms of their coverage of the different CWEs. So targeted to developers and security practitioners, the CWE serves as a formal list of software weaknesses that serve multiple functions. They provide a common language for describing software security weaknesses in architecture, design, or code. They provide a measuring stick for software security tools targeting these weaknesses and provide a common baseline for weakness identification, mitigation, and prevention efforts. As the public and private sector seek to acquire software that's been verified and validated against known security flaws, a service like the CWE list becomes even more invaluable. The MITRE CWE lists, definitions, and descriptions support the overall finding of these common types of software security flaws in code prior to fielding. And this also means that both users and developers of software assurance tools and services now have a mechanism for providing and describing each of the industry's security software security flaw code assessment capabilities in terms of their coverage of the different CWEs. A future end goal of the CWE effort is to ultimately take the various findings and results from the CWE list and use them as the foundation of a CWE compatibility program that can be used directly by organizations in their selection and evaluation of tools or services for assessing their acquired software for known types of weaknesses. The Common Vulnerability Scoring System. This is the National Infrastructure and Advisory Council launched the first iteration of the CVSS system in 2005. In April of the same year, the NIAC assigned the Forum for Incident Response and Security Teams the first to manage the CVSS system. CVSS version 2 was updated and launched in 2007, with the most up-to-date version being CVSS version 3 being released in 2015. That version is the one we've used for our overall analysis, as it is the most current. The CVSS provides a framework for capturing the principal technical characteristics of software, hardware, and firmware vulnerabilities, and provide a numerical score reflecting its overall severity. The CVSS consists of three metric groups, base, temporal, and environmental. The base is obviously represents the intrinsic qualities of a vulnerability that are constant over time and across user environments. Temporal reflects the characteristics of a vulnerability over time and its changes, as well as environmental represents the characteristics of a vulnerability that are unique to a specific environment. The base metrics produce a score ranging from 0 to 10, which can then be modified by scoring the temporal and environmental metrics. A CVSS score is also represented as a vector string, which is a compressed textual representation of the values used to derive the overall score. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, National Vulnerability Database, is responsible for verifying vulnerabilities by assigning them a corresponding base CVSS value. The NVD supports utilizing both CVSS 2 and 3 standards. The CVSS 2 was limited to only 3 severity rankings, low, medium, and high. The CVSS 3 standards include 4 severity rankings, none, low, medium, high, and critical. The NVD does not currently provide temporal scores, the metrics that change over time due to events external to the vulnerability, or environmental scores customized to reflect the impact of the vulnerability on a specific organization. The NVD does provide a CVSS score calculator, so users can add their own temporal and environmental score information. This calculator contains support for U.S. government agencies to customize vulnerability impact scores based on Federal Information Processing Standard, that's FIPS, publication 199. FIPS 199 is also the standards for security categorization of federal information secure systems, which is a government standard designed to establish security categories of information systems used by the federal government. So, discussing the overall findings of the various flaw types that we discovered during our analysis. These are the top 10 common weakness and enumeration instances that took place. These are the overall CWE values attributed to those vulnerabilities, but the greatest number of them obviously are CWE 119, 125, and 416. These specific flaw types provide particular characterization and classification of the weakness itself. The five flaw types I list here account for more than half of all vulnerabilities disclosed by the various research vendors. So CWE 119 is improper restriction of operations within the bounds of a memory buffer. That ultimately has an impact on the buffer of the system's memory and allow information to be read, sensitive information to be read, or potentially cause the system to crash. Out of bounds read is CWE 125. A CWE 416 is a use after free. CWE 787, improper input validation, and CWE 200, information exposure. All of these themselves are account for, again, more than half of all vulnerabilities discovered and disclosed by all 12 research organizations. The primary applications exploited for during the analysis and the categorization of the vulnerabilities associated to particular applications, the overwhelming majority were targeted to PDF readers, such as Adobe Acrobat, Foxit, Phantom PDF. And this is understandable considering this is the most common file format shared in use today. It is ubiquitous. It is agnostic to operating systems. It doesn't matter if it's Mac or Windows or Linux. The PDF file can be read and also has the ability to add additional security functions and capabilities to protect the data within. But ultimately, these hackers seek to find weaknesses in the most popular programs. You want to make sure that if you are going to develop a compromise or a comprehensive compromise of a system, it's the one that is most used and most frequently going to be implemented, so that any effort is compounded through popularity. So as I mentioned, portable document software, internet browsers obviously are primary means of accessing the internet. Google's Android OS is the dominant operating system in the mobile device market, with Chrome as the default browser. And as a result, vulnerabilities discovered in this browser grant hackers a significant number of overall potential targets, ultimately seeking to provide the largest bang for their buck in efforts to compromise systems. Operating systems, obviously, Microsoft Windows is the most predominant operating system, so it makes sense that they also are the most frequently targeted operating system by hackers. And firmware systems. These software and hardware updates are the primary efforts sought by hackers, as ultimately granting them access and control over the software, the hardware, or the firmware system on the particular device. And as a result, many times the firmware code vendors use to update their own products is itself flawed and ends up introducing entirely new vulnerabilities on its own. So these vulnerabilities are the most critical of all to ultimately address. The vulnerability severity scores conducted as part of our research were attributed. The overwhelming majority were the high category classified by the CVSS version 3. With medium coming in second and critical coming in third. The associated CVSS score attached to each vulnerability by the National Vulnerability Database provides organizations with a visible metric to gauge the severity associated with any vulnerability and help to provide methods for prioritization of threat remediation strategies. Critical threats are those that have been potentially catastrophic impacts on an organization's information security. These threats typically surround unauthorized root level access, can result in the modification, disclosure, or denial of service, and are often elevated to this level if an attacker can gain access without any special conditions or knowledge. High score threats have a substantial damaging effect on information security of an organization. However, these vulnerabilities are traditionally more challenging to exploit as they require certain conditions be met, such as advanced knowledge and capabilities. Although any exploit can still result in privilege escalation of loss of access to data. Medium vulnerabilities can have negative impacts on an organization's data security, but often are more challenging to exploit as specific requirements must be met in order for the exploit for the vulnerability to be exploited effectively. And then low to NA scored vulnerabilities have little to no impact on the data security for an organization and pose more of an annoyance than a legitimate threat. The number of critically disclosed vulnerabilities by any organization, Trend Micro, Cisco, and Checkpoint, the top three, with Trend Micro having discovered more than Cisco and Checkpoint combined. The high disclosed vulnerabilities, Trend Micro came out with over almost 600 high classified CVSS scores for these vulnerabilities. And medium disclosed vulnerabilities, Trend Micro came out at 225 with Google and Palo Alto Networks coming in second and third. The CVSS score summary ultimately is that the base score for any vulnerabilities derived by these three calculated metrics: the exploitability score, which is attributed to the vulnerability to rank the ease by which the vulnerability can be exploited. So ultimately, the higher the score, the easier the vulnerability is to exploit, and is calculated based on four metrics: the attack vector, which is reflects the context at which vulnerability exploitation is possible; the attack complexity, ultimately describes the conditions beyond the attacker's control that must exist in order for a vulnerability to be exploited; the whether or not privileges are required, so this metric ultimately describes the level of privileges an attacker has to possess before being able to successfully exploit the vulnerability; and user interaction captures the requirement for a human user other than the attacker to participate in the successful compromise of the vulnerability component. In addition to the exploitability score, there's the impact score, which ranks the effects of a successfully exploited vulnerability on the component that suffers the worst outcome that is most directly and predictably associated with the attack. and it's based on three metrics: confidentiality, integrity, and availability. The sub-impact score is ultimately determined by whether or not the scope has changed. So the scope being the impact of a vulnerability other than the vulnerable component. So if an ancillary system, a other connected component that is not that may not have the vulnerability is ultimately affected by the connected component's vulnerability. As part of our overall analytical summary, over 50% of the vulnerability market itself disclosed through the dozen vendors we conducted research on, Trend Micro disclosed and managed the disclosure of more than half. The overall, Trend Micro captured 916 vulnerabilities that were managed. Average base score for their vulnerabilities was quite high at 7.64. Average of exploitability score is 2.49. The average impact score is over 5. So of all the vulnerabilities listed, the next two were Cisco and Google, which still those two combined accounted for about a quarter of the total vulnerability market coverage. Overall final results of our analysis, the average base score for all reported vulnerabilities was just over 7.4. And that places the average score for all vulnerabilities firmly in the high severity ranking. The average exploitability score for all reported vulnerabilities was 2.4, and is derived from a pretty complex calculation. Specific 8.22 times in the attack vector by attack complexity, the privileges required, and user interaction. And the average impact score for all reported vulnerabilities was just over 4.9. which is derived from an addition other calculation of the scope, whether depending upon whether or not the scope is changed or unchanged. Trend Micro's ZDI was responsible for managing over 50% of all vulnerabilities reported by the dozen research organizations we reviewed as part of our analysis. The average base CVSS score for all vulnerabilities, as mentioned, was 7.64. The average exploitability score for CDI was 2.4, and the average impact score for all ZDI managed vulnerabilities was just over 5. With that great deal of coverage of the market research when it comes to vulnerabilities, I pass the discussion off to John Clay to be able to provide more insight into the capabilities and offerings of Trend Micro Zero Day.
Thank you, Tanner. Appreciate that information. It's great information for everybody who wants to really understand how the vulnerability market works and what each of these vulnerabilities means, the impact, et cetera. It was really good to help our audience understand the differences, whether it's CVE, CWE, CVSS, et cetera. So, the interesting thing about this marketplace is that it is a critical one. We have some folks at the UN meeting this week, and they're talking about governments, whether the government should keep vulnerabilities or disclose vulnerabilities. And as we saw with WannaCry, through the hackers that got into the NSA database, they were able to steal the exploit code that they had been storing and unleashed WannaCry on the world. Obviously, responsibly disclosing vulnerabilities is a critical component to the general health of the systems out there in the world. So, the Zero Day Initiative, this is a organization that we purchased from HP, but they've been around since 2005. And when you look at Trend Micro research, it is one component of multiple areas that Trend Micro does research in, whether it's the cyber threats themselves, the targeted attacks, to IoT, IIoT, et cetera. Zero Day Initiative is one of the arms of our vulnerability research that has really helped Trend Micro to understand this area, understand how vulnerabilities work, and As an agnostic bug bounty program, it is one that has helped us not only drive improvements in our technology and our products, but it also helps us to educate the market out there. So helping our customers, whether it's consumers, businesses, government agencies, we are able to provide them a lot of information through the educational side, whether it's alerts, blogs, news, et cetera, free tools that we offer. Where Zero Day Initiative comes in is that coordinated disclosure. So we work with many of those operating system and application vendors. And one of the beauties of the Zero Day Initiative is that we actually help educate the vendors on how to manage their patch process. And I'll give you an example. Recently, we have been dealing with human-machine interface software vendors. Over the last several years, we've had a lot of our 3,500-plus researchers outside of Trend Micro that submit the bugs to the Zero Day Initiative for a bounty. And we'd bring them to the HMI vendors. And at the time, you know, this is a couple of years ago, they didn't really understand it. So they didn't patch very often. And through our support and our help with them understanding that why they needed to patch, we have now started to see a very good rate of them actually providing patches to their customers on a regular basis. So, you know, just to give you some background on Zero Day Initiative, basically we purchase Zero Days from independent researchers. So as I mentioned, there's about 3,500 of these researchers around the world who submit bugs to us. We are the largest vendor agnostic bug bounty program, meaning we don't really care who, what products are submitted to us, whether it's operating systems, mobile operating systems, whether it's applications, critical applications, we take any and all of those, and we work with those vendors to make sure that they are able to provide a patch. You can see over the years, it has grown steadily. We've seen, you know, pretty big growth, and, you know, as Tanner mentioned earlier, in this study, there was only about 900 plus vulnerabilities that the Zero Day Initiative disclosed. But that obviously, we had to weed out a bunch of them because of the qualifications and requirements that the IHS market put on the vendors in order to be able to submit a bug as part of it. But you can see in 2018, we had 1,450 bugs that we submitted. And then zero day disclosures has been increasing each year, these are ones that we don't like because these are the vulnerabilities that the vendors have chosen not to publish a patch for. We still publish the vulnerability information because we feel the public is more informed about, and they can then take, obviously, ways to prevent the use of or an exploit exploiting that vulnerability. So whether it's through IPS or IDS type technology. Zero Day Initiative also has three events that we are now doing. They're called Pawn to Own. These events are located in different parts of the world. But Pawn to Own Vancouver is the one that's kind of the flagship that's been around since 2005. And basically the focus here is we bring in the researchers themselves. They will do a POC of the bug, and we have the vendors with us at that event. And then they go in the back room and help them understand what is the bug, how does it work, how to patch it. The focus of Pawn to Own Vancouver is on enterprise software and operating system. We also, a number of years ago, announced Pawn to Own Tokyo, and that is to focus on the mobile platform market as well as IoT, consumer IoT. And we just recently announced a new one that's coming up in 2020 called Pawn to Own Miami, and that's going to bring in critical infrastructure and ICS vendors together with the researchers who are going to be looking to identify bugs within that area of the industry. So we're looking really forward to these. These events give us a lot of good information and intelligence, as well as a really good understanding of these different areas of the computing landscape. We also have something we call the Targeted Incentive Program. This is somewhat unique in that We can actually increase the bounties on key applications or operating systems that we know our customers are needing and they utilize more effectively inside their organization. So you can see here a number of these bounties upwards of $200,000 on, for example, Ubuntu server, a couple of Ubuntu servers, some Windows Server ones, whether it's Windows 10, Windows 8, et cetera. These are ways that we can incentivize our researchers to really target into those critical applications, critical operating systems that are being used by our customers in order to identify those bugs. One of the big benefits why we have this organization as part of Trend Micro Research is because of what we call pre-disclosed protection. And in 2018, of those 1,450, you can see we are a top supplier of bugs to Microsoft. And on average, we had 31 days of zero-day pre-disclosed filter coverage. Now, what that means is that as part of the zero-day initiative, there's also we have a product line called Tipping Point, which is a network IPS. And what happens is when that bug is submitted to us, we start working on a IDS filter. And we're able to provide our Tipping Point customers a filter to block any exploit of that vulnerability before a patch has been published. And you can see here we had almost a month, we had a month of support protection for our customers for Microsoft bugs. We do the same thing with Adobe. You can see we had almost 40 days of pre-disclosed filter coverage in 2018. And then in WannaCry's example, I mentioned WannaCry earlier, we had 43 days of coverage before the ransomware was actually unleashed to the world. So customers were able to protect their systems upwards of 43 days with virtual patches before that. And if we look at all of the bugs submitted in 2018, we had on average 62 days of zero-day pre-disclosed filter coverage. So that's the main benefit. One of the key benefits to our Tipping Point customers and our customers in general of IPS IDS protection. So to conclude this, again, I mentioned it's the world's largest bug bounty program. It grows every year. Bounty programs impact everyone. It helps us understanding. It guides our research. It guides our patches. We're able to use that targeted incentive program to really look at key applications, operating systems that support our customers. This marketplace is growing. We have a lot of gray and black market options out there for researchers. What we are trying to do is get that vulnerability off the market and put it into the hands of the good people so that we can responsibly and coordinate a disclosure of that vulnerability. I mentioned earlier about nation states taking those things. We are trying to make sure that those nation states don't keep those bugs, and hopefully we can find those. But even if they do keep them, we hope that our community will be able to find that vulnerability quickly, and then we can produce a patch. And then lastly, zero-day vulnerabilities become one-day exploits. So as we know with Patch Tuesday, for example, when there is a new vulnerability disclosed every day, that is an opportunity for the malicious actors out there to identify and create an exploit and utilize that exploit. And as Tanner mentioned, that window of opportunity is going to be there on all of these. And as I just showed just most recently there, we had 62 days of pre-disclosed support. So we are definitely working to minimize that window of opportunity that the malicious actors can take. And so now I would like to open it up to Q&A. And I do see that we have a couple of questions here. But again, if you have a question for us, feel free to open that widget, a Q&A widget on your desktop, and ask us a question. So here's a question. Tanner, if a vendor elects for whatever reason not to mitigate a discovered vulnerability, is there a database or requirement for the vendor to notify end users of the software or hardware that there was a found vulnerability in?
That's a really interesting question. There are specific requirements outlined in the concept of responsible disclosure, that any vendor or organization that is aware of a vulnerability in a system has a requirement of due diligence to inform their respective users of a discovered vulnerability. However, there are limitations with regards to outdated or applications or software that have been disbanded or that a company has announced they are no longer providing support for. So if a vulnerability on Windows 95 is discovered, Microsoft currently has no requirement to provide a address that vulnerability because they have announced long ago that they were going to abandon support for that operating system. There are specific compliance requirements as well. Various federal laws have taken place, like the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act of 2015, the Federal Exchange and Data Breach Notification Act of the same year. So, I mean, if a vendor, for whatever reason, refuses to disclose information or mitigate a vulnerability, they risk not only government fines and additional complications, but great public scrutiny as well that are likely to have a substantial impact on their ability to continue to do business ethically.
Yeah, and that brings up a good point. One of the things that we do within our bug bounty program, the ZDI, is when we will inform the vendor if they have chosen not to patch something for whatever reason that might be, right? We will inform them that we will be disclosing it. As I mentioned before, we do disclose zero-day vulnerabilities on a regular basis through the ZDI program. And there have been many cases where we have informed them that, and then all of a sudden they will come back and say, oh, yeah, well, we will patch it. So we are trying to make vendors accountable to their software and the bugs that are found. And that is another benefit that I think bug bounty programs in general bring to the table for organizations. So excellent. Appreciate that. Let's see. Here's another question. What steps can end users take to protect themselves from vulnerabilities, in your opinion?
Ultimately, you have to, for end users of any kind, be it the enterprise or consumer level, the only way to protect your ecosystem is to first know what what comprises it. You have to know all of your systems, all of your endpoints, all of your devices. You have to basically conduct a security audit on your own individual systems to know what are authenticated, what have authorized access, what may be rogue devices that are connected that don't have authorization to connect. But you need to be aware of all the components that comprise your overall ecosystem, as well as the various operating systems and software components running on those devices and making sure that they are up to date and current. That is a monumental effort for many organizations, especially extremely large ones, as you can have endpoints in the tens of thousands, if not millions, of endpoints to manage. So there are endpoint detection and response solutions that exist, overall management systems, but it requires the end user, be it floor manager responsible for 10,000 devices or a consumer with six devices at home, making sure that you are aware of the systems operating on those devices and making sure that each one of them are updated and patched, because you cannot, as John alluded to earlier and mentioned, even the ability to provide those vulnerabilities and those patches, that's phenomenal, and that's the ultimate objective, is to address these issues. The problem is they're only addressed through an update, and unless the end user conducts that update, their system is still at risk. So the end user, the manufacturer, the vendor, can only do so much to update and find the flaws. But once those flaws are discovered and they put out a patch, it is up to the end user to install it and make sure it's operating effectively. The vendor's capabilities are limited once their product is out the door.
Yeah, and I think that brings up another point. You made a great point about asset management, understanding what systems you have out there, which ones are vulnerable, That's a regular thing you have to do as an organization. The other thing that I think is interesting, Tanner, and maybe you can address this, is, you know, obviously you mentioned MITRE had 30,000 vulnerabilities in 2018. Obviously, organizations aren't going to patch, you know, do you have to patch all of those? Is there a recommendation from your understanding in terms of how should they prioritize patches?
That actually plays into the vulnerability scoring system that is put out by the U.S. government, being able to take the baseline for a particular system and be able to prioritize your threat mitigation response. So you, if it's a low priority or even maybe medium, you obviously you're going to take care of that after you. Different structures, different ecosystems in place.
Okay. Tanner, I think we might have lost you for a moment there. Can you just repeat a little bit last
time? Sure,
I'm
sorry. I apologize. You can hear me now?
Yep, we can.
Okay. I'm sorry. What I was saying is that each system, each organization is going to be unique. And so the ability to apply that that scoring system to your own ecosystem and the customized and unique factors that come into play allow you to develop a prioritization system to address high and critical threats and put medium and low or non-existent threats on a back burner to address that. That's what that government scoring system that I recommend or I discussed provides. It provides end users that ability to kind of prioritize and develop their own threat mitigation strategy.
Yeah, and then obviously organizations need to look at, you know, of those critical vulnerabilities, high vulnerabilities, which ones actually do we utilize? And then of those, which ones are being actively exploited out there in the world, right? Obviously, the actively exploited ones are really key. Do you know of any resources that our audience can get to in terms of the finding out information about actively exploited vulnerabilities?
That is entirely up to the operating system, the services, the solutions that they're looking to provide a deeper dive into. There are, you know, from Trend Micro ZDI solution to open source intelligence collection. It's ultimately going to depend upon the application of that research to their unique solution. There are various resources such as Dark Reading that provide information on capabilities and new developments of new vulnerabilities that have been exploited or new ways to address solutions or address the vulnerabilities that are being discovered. How these vulnerabilities have kind of populated and mitigated or proliferated in the wild. So it's ultimately going to depend upon the kind of solution or the kind of service they're looking to provide. But there is there are a wealth of opportunities for further research available.
Excellent. All right. Well, I think we've run out of time and we've run out of questions at this point. Tanner, I do want to thank you for obviously your organization taking a lot of time into this, looking at the actively researching a lot of the public information to try and give us a somewhat unbiased view of the research vulnerability research market. We are looking forward to looking at 2019 data once this year ends to see how everybody has done. And I'm also more interested in seeing if there's any changes in which applications, which operating systems have the most vulnerabilities being disclosed over this year. There might be a shift in that. I do know that the ZDI, we are on target to have another increase in the number of vulnerabilities disclosed in 2019 compared to 2018, the data we had here. So with that, I do want to thank everybody in the audience. We have recorded this, so if you have colleagues that you think would be beneficial in listening to this webinar. We will have this up on our website, the Trend Micro website, as a recorded one, and you can share that with your audience. We will also be providing you with these slides for your use internally to your organization. Ken, I do want to thank you again for your support of this.
Thank you very much, John. It was a pleasure to work with you and look forward to doing so in the future.
Yep, and thank you, everybody. Have a great rest of your day, and we will talk later. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for checking out this podcast. I know that you will get a big benefit out of this webinar as I did. A lot of research went into it, and it's quite interesting and a different change to the podcast than normal day-to-day routines. There are other webinars that I'll be publishing in due time, and those are Phishing Insights and Social Media, and that was quite interesting itself, and the 2020 predictions from Trend Micro, how they get their predictions. You know, they're not always right, but you know, based on their research and such, they talk about that and what they are looking to see over time. And I bet you, as I get a notification from Ted on YouTube, that these could be on YouTube somewhere. But I know that they were done in respective venues, and I taped it so that you all will be able to have something different. And I hope that you enjoy them, and they'll be coming up soon. I'll also continue to be working on assignment 18, and I'll give you a final report when it's finally graded. Until next podcast, everybody, I am Jared Reimer saying thanks so much for listening. My email address is tech, that's T-E-C-H, at menvi.org. And if you are the text message variety, or you're international, you have WhatsApp, you can send a text or voice message using the phone number 804-442-6975. I hope to be back on another edition of the program very soon. And thanks so much for listening.